Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Experience summer comfort for less. Explore our sale on curtains and bedding. Perfect time to update and freshen your home.
Cullum O'Mungoin here, 087-484-8888 for your WhatsApps. You probably heard that news in the last few minutes that the drug HHC is now classified as an illegal drug. That's a synthetic cannabis type drug. It's hexahydrocannabinol. It's been in the country since around 2022. People might be aware of it being sold in vapes and jellies and the like, and it has now been banned. It's just been announced by the Minister for Health. It's one of 14 new substances, according to the statement coming out from the Department of Health, including synthetic opioids and semi-synthetic cannabinoids, newly classified as controlled drugs. That's on foot of moves in the EU and the UN, indeed. That HHC drug, though, linked to it's been highlighted in that same statement of study in Galway by University College Galway that it was a key factor in people presenting with episodes of psychosis. We'd welcome your thoughts from listeners on that move, 087 484 8888 for your WhatsApps on that, because their concerns had been raised by parents and psychiatrists and the like. There may be people on the other side of the argument who think that prohibition doesn't work, that this isn't the way to deal with it. It just adds another drug to the list of drugs that Gardaí are already have to contend with, and you know, for people who make the argument for legalisation, they might want to get in touch too. 087 484 8888. We're going to turn though to the EU-US deal, whether it was a good deal, whether it was a bad deal, what might have happened, we'll never know. The reality at the moment is that EU goods going into the US are facing a 15% tariff. Goods coming in the other direction, no tariff. So did the EU blink? Did the US win? Or did the EU stabilise a pretty dicey situation and make the best possible deal? Eimear Dunn, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. How are you?
You're coming from the perspective of a dairy farmer. So what's your take on it?
My take on it is that, you know, you have to have something like with like. You know, 15% tariff of EU product going into America, European Union, at 15%. And then on the other side, they can send their products into or to the European Union at 0%. How can anybody justify that that is fair? I can't justify that is fair. And the worrying part is that Ireland exports 58%, right? That's the statistics that they have out there. So, therefore, the person that's going to lose out the most is Ireland. Like, our Taoiseach says it's a good deal. I personally don't think it's a good deal. I think we were just... She just went in there and agreed that there was no thinking of this at all.
And do you think the EU because should have hit back with punitive tariffs, got into a trade war, tried to weather that storm to come out with a lower tariff on the other side of it? Do you think they should have gone into a trade war in the short term?
Trade war, I don't think anybody wants a trade war. But what I do think is that you can't have something going with 50% one way and 0% the other way. You can't have that. You know, it doesn't add up. It doesn't seem right. What was the thinking of this? Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm looking at the perspective, okay, you say dairy farming, and that's true. That's one end of it. But there's other end of it, like the pharmaceutical end of it. There's jobs there that are going to be lost. And if that money isn't coming into the Irish economy, where is it going to leave us? Throw us into recession.
Well, I suppose the argument that had been made is nobody could point to an exact number of jobs that would actually be lost of people who are currently working where they thought it might affect things would be investment decision made for future jobs in Ireland.
Yeah.
But I suppose on the other side of things, in the customers in the US will ultimately end up paying more. This 15%, you know, it won't be paid by the exporters, it'll be paid by customers on the other side, where this effective tax by the US will be passed on to customers. People in Europe won't have to pay that tax, and as a result, European inflation won't be contributed to by adding more to the cost of importing US goods.
Yeah, but will they go elsewhere? If it's too expensive for them to buy this stuff, will they go elsewhere to a different economy?
So are you concerned that the American preferences would change if EU goods become more expensive?
Yes. Well, you look at the way things are at the moment, it's changing all the time. You can't say that they'll agree to one thing because 5 minutes later they change their mind. So I don't know where this is all going to end up. Do you know what I mean? All I know is that Ireland is going to be the economy that's going to be hit the most because we're the ones that are exporting the most.
And do you think there's any potential advantage of, you know, the post-Brexit arrangements where there are, for example, you know, creameries in the north where Irish dairy farmers could potentially send their milk north of the border where they'd avail of a 10% tariff rate into the US? Is there an opportunity there for particularly for dairy farmers on the border?
The problem with that's going to be is that, and there is a very potential for that happening, because if it's a case that it's 10% in England, so therefore if it's 15% up here, there is a potential for things to be moved up to north.
So what would you have done?
That's in everything.
What would you have done in this situation? Because we kept hearing about this EU big bazooka and that, you know, where effectively there would be targeting of particular US goods for very high tariffs and have a very intensive, contentious period of trade war to try and, you know, show the US that there was damage that the EU could do to trade. And as a result, the US might blink and cut a more favourable deal. Do you think with the current administration in Washington that that would have been a wise road to go down?
I don't really. I never thought of that one. But there had to be something mediator between the two. Like, you can't have one way going one way and the other way with zero. No, they can put whatever they want into the EU, you know. So I don't know what they're going to put in. And what if they do put it in, why have we not got tariffs for them to put their stuff into us? That I don't understand.
Well, I suppose entering into this arrangement, the logic in the US head was, they say, and you know, that there is a deficit between what the US imports. So basically, they take more imports than they export. And they think this is unfair. The European attitude was, look, the European Union imports more American services. And if you take that into account, America has a trade surplus with Europe. The US didn't accept that. They only looked at goods and they were going to slap on 30% tariffs. There's now only 15%. Is it the best of a bad lot?
You see, the problem is your jobs are going to be lost here because it has to go. If you're going to put a 15% tariff on stuff, they have to make up the money somewhere, right? So where do you want to make up the money? The money is going to be lost because it's going to go back down the chain. And if you're looking for the agri-sector, the person that's going to end up losing the most here is the fella producing the food.
Well, you tell us.
They have to pass it back.
Well, you tell us how you see it from your point of view. You know, coming from that sector, I know your concern is general, but I suppose the deepest insight you have is into the agri sector and particularly milk. So, where do you see the danger for your sector there?
What I see the danger for a sector is if you're going to put up a 15% tariff on products going into the US, right? If the product gets too dear and there is another economy, say China or something like that or whatever, and they can give that product cheaper, who do you think they're going to buy it from? It all comes down to money.
I suppose as against that,
and
people
jobs
might...
Jobs will be lost.
But, you know, as against that, you know, there is no reason on paper really why US customers would be buying gold-wrapped butter from Ireland, which, you know, is a premium product in the US,
yeah,
when they can always buy a cheaper US product. But the selling point of Irish dairy produce is that the grass-fed cattle who are outdoors for most of the year, that's a premium product. Irish beef is the, you know, the same selling point is made. So 15% on an already premium product. Do people who buy premium products care about 15% either way?
It all depends if the premium product you're talking about, because going over, there is a tariff on it anyway. So is that 15% on top of what's already there, or is this just the 15% tariff?
Well, as we understand it at the moment, there won't be what they call stacking, that this 15% tariff comes instead of any other rate that was being talked about. So it's 15% right across the board. And what's coming out from the Americans today seems to be that that also includes pharmaceutical and other sectors. But if you go back to what the European Commission was saying earlier today, he was a spokesperson on Morning Ireland earlier, they were saying that, look, this is just a framework. At the moment, it's a blanket 15%, but this is only a framework document. The details still have to be worked out, and there is room for negotiations about certain carve-outs with lower or zero tariffs in the future. So what would you be telling the Irish government to feed into the European negotiation position, you know, to make the pitch on behalf of the sector that you're most passionate about?
What I'm most passionate about is being fair to everybody. The problem is because we export so much out, we are going to be the losers here, no matter what way you look at it. And I don't think that that was took into consideration when this deal was being made.
And do you think slapping tariffs on US goods? Would you think slapping tariffs on US goods would help in any way? Because the 15% is still going to be the 15%, and the concern might be that tariffs on the EU end of things might make the US go, well, you know, we'll see your 15 and we'll add another 5, and then it just gets into this escalation that, you know, the Trump administration seems to have an appetite for.
Well, it might make them bring it down to 10%.
And is that worth the risk when the headline tariff they were talking about was that from August 1st, it'd be 30%?
The problem is it worth the risk of people losing their jobs? Is it worth the risk that people's livelihoods is affected? Is it worth the risk that Ireland ends up going into recession? Is it worth all that risk? My opinion, it needs to be a better negotiation than what we have here, 15% to 0%.
Okay, all right, Emer. Kevin, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colm. How are you keeping?
I'm not too bad now. You were listening to Emer there. She thinks it's a bad deal. 15% on EU goods going into the US, zero tariffs on US goods coming into the EU. What's your own take?
Well, at the end of the day, tariffs are a tax on the consumer. So the American consumer are going to be paying 15% more on products they import from Europe. And we're not being penalised by importing products the other way. So at the end of the day, tariffs are going to be imposed, looks like, globally on virtually every country, because he's got a thing for tariffs. He always have had. He's never been in favour of free trade, and this is just the way he thinks. But at the end of the day, all they've sat down and agreed is we're going to announce that these are the headline figures, and then we're going to stand back and let the civil servants thrash out all of the details. We know from years and years of negotiations over Brexit, all of the details takes years to work through. It just does. Mm. And it does. And they're talking to countries all around the world. So the notion that even a competent government could sit down and negotiate a full economic trade deal across the board in 2 years is laughable. This is not a competent government that they have in the US.
Right, I suppose
that's firefights everywhere. All they're doing. This is firefighting. No more.
The difference between the Brexit negotiations and this set of negotiations is that Britain was a much smaller economy than the European Union, and they needed the market access to the European Union. So the greater leverage was with the European Union, and also the way the European Union negotiated, set the timetable, set the terms of reference for those negotiations mm-hmm. was really an exercise in playing a strong hand, and some would even argue nearly playing it too strongly from the point of view of the EU. But this negotiation is very different.
It is and it isn't, because you have to look at it two ways. There is no way in God's green earth that the pharmaceutical sector that we have here, that we've developed for 40, 50 years, are going to be influenced by basically a one-term president whose economic policies are off the wall, mad. They'll ride this out because they know that the next guy is probably going to be somewhere normal and they can deal with normal. They can't plan for this guy. You can't make long-term plans. Companies can't make long-term plans for what Trump is going to do. But he's 6 months in, and it's a basket case.
From Donald Trump's point of view, the dollar has gone down, 15% in value. That's good for U.S. exports. They've got 0% tariffs coming into the European Union. That's good for U.S. exports as well. So arguably, from the point of view of the export economy, what Donald Trump has done is advantage America. On the other side, you could argue that 15% tariff on European goods and a weaker dollar means more inflation within the US, and how that plays out only remains to be seen.
This is it. But the other side of it is you've got to look at it. I've got plenty of family and friends who live over there. I talk to them on a daily basis. They're not happy. Even the ones that I know voted for Trump, and I know the reasons why they voted for Trump, but they're not happy because what he promised and what he's delivering are two completely different things. And they're seeing the wood through the trees now for the first time. And they're starting to ask serious questions about why is my food constantly going up? Why is my wages not matching inflation? Why is all this stuff happening? Why is the cost of living going through the roof? You promised all of this stuff is coming down. He's not very popular. Despite what the persona that he gives off, he really isn't. His popularity is on the floor.
So what do you say when you look at Emer's argument, she's looking at a deal where there's 15% tariffs on EU goods going into the European Union, and she's seeing 0% on US goods. And I suppose the question she was raising, I think I'm being fair in representing your position here on this, Emer, is that, where was the effort made to cause the US maybe a bit of pain to get them to rethink the tariff rates that might be implied on us? Am I accurately summing up your position there, Emer?
Yeah.
So, Kevin, what would you say to that?
Well, what you're asking is why are the EU not punishing us, our citizens, with a tax from importing US products? Because that's what it is.
Well, I suppose
if Trump wants to put a tax, which is a tariff, a tax on his own consumer base, good luck. That's your lookout. Why should we cut our nose off to spite our face?
The other way of looking
what benefit is it?
Why would the EU not put pressure on large, influential US businesses who would in turn say to Donald Trump, look, this 30% tariff rate or 15% tariff rate is madness. We're all hurting here. We're going to lose jobs in key red states, and there'd be congressional pressure on Donald Trump to just stop this. Like he stopped before when the markets gave him a kicking.
But Colin, you got to say, he's not standing again. He doesn't care. He's not a Republican. He's a Trumpist. He is me, myself, and I in a nutshell. He is not standing again. He doesn't care. He knows that this is his one and only chance, and he knows he's only got a year and a half left.
All right. So do you think it's
free reign?
You're not in favor of tariffs. That's abundantly clear. Is it a bad deal?
It's about as good as what we could have got. I think if the tariffs had been in and along the lines of what Canada was, it could have been a lot worse. I look at the tariffs that are being imposed all over the world and the countries that provide pharmaceuticals into the US, we're still competitive because the tariffs have caused prices to go up for everybody.
Okay.
So we're still on a level playing field. The world is still on a level playing field. But what it has done is forced Ireland to start looking at other consumers around the world.
All right, except for the UK.
Other deals elsewhere.
The UK has a 5% advantage on the European Union in this.
They do, but I wouldn't be surprised to see the detail worked out on that to negate that.
Okay.
I think there might be something with the Brexit deal that might come into play and See, this is the thing. We're all guessing as to what the details are. We just don't know yet.
Well, nobody, and as
no,
you
we
say,
know the headline, no, no, nobody, we just don't know.
Nobody knows yet. And the European Commission spokesperson, Olaf Gill, who, if I'm not mistaken, I think comes from Clare Island, was saying that earlier on Morning Ireland, that, look, this is the headline deal. This is the framework. Details to be revealed. We might come back to it when we get more detail on it and we can hammer this out again. We're going to take a break. Back in a minute.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Now, a letter from Lord Mayor of Dublin, Ray McAdam, has winged its way to Michelle and Barack Obama to ask them to formally accept the honour of Freedom of the City of Dublin, which was bestowed on them in 2017 and has been bestowed on many other people, also been revoked in some cases. But in 2017, Dublin City Council voted by a pretty narrow majority to bestow the Freedom of the City on Michelle and Barack Obama. They didn't get a chance to formally pick it up, but Barack Obama is returning to the city in September for an all-ticket event to be interviewed by Fintan O'Toole in front of a live audience, and Ray McAdam wants the Obamas to pick up the award while they are back in the city. Is it a good idea? Is this the time to be bestowing the Freedom of the City, or to the formal bestowing of the Freedom of the City on a US president, with all that's going on in the world at the moment, and when we've had the luxury of a number of years to look at what the legacy of Barack Obama is? Vincent Kenny, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colm. How are you?
I'm not too bad, thanks. So what's your take on it? Ray McAdam has taken the opportunity to write to the Obamas to formally pick up the award. Is he right?
Well, I mean, I think the idea of Barack Obama being awarded the Lord Mayor, being awarded the First Citizen of Dublin, was perfectly acceptable the first time around. I don't see anything wrong with him coming to Dublin. I wouldn't pay money to hear an interview with anyone, never mind Barack Obama. But yeah, of course, why shouldn't he? I mean, ironically, the link between Obama, we're about to talk about, you know, other controversial things that's happening in the world. Mm. Why should we be afraid of letting him be First Citizen of Dublin, given that, you know, famous Lord Mayor of Dublin, Daniel O'Connell, in 1841, he was the first Catholic Lord Mayor of Dublin. And Frederick Douglass, the most famous black abolitionist, and O'Connell had the closest friendship ever insofar as the abolition of slavery. And Obama, Michelle and Barack are both slaves of Irish men and women. Well, Irish men, certainly. Both of them come from slavery, and they're proud to
not in the case of Barack Obama. His family came from Kenya originally, and so the African side of Barack Obama's heritage comes from Africa rather than through the slavery inheritance.
I've worked in Kenya. I got my doctorate in Kenya, so I'm very fond of Kenya. But Obama certainly has spoken about his Kearney relationship with Ireland, and there's a statue of the two of them down in, is it Offaly, where they went. So there's a statue of Obama and Michelle and Barack, you know, promoting their Irish heritage. But the link I'm talking about is that, but Michelle also, she's happy to point to Irish heritage links, and both of them were slavery linked. And Douglas, and the former first Catholic Lord Mayor of Dublin, was a slavery operation.
Yeah, and Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass wrote very fondly of his time in Ireland and the absence of racism in his time there, and how he was greeted, and indeed commented pretty unfavourably about the condition of tenant farmers in Ireland when he was touring the country. Mm-hmm. and in the company of Obama, O'Connell also had, you know, an interest in the emancipation of Jews in Europe. He was an advocate against anti-Semitism in England as well during his time over there. But I mean, look, is there too much hype about, you know, Barack Obama? Did Ireland lose the run of itself, you know, with the whole Is Féidearlin thing? Did it get caught up in the hype for somebody who, when you look at their legacy on the world stage, people would say it's a very mixed bag?
Well, you know, I suppose the reason, I won't say I'm fairly neutral in these issues, but I am fairly tired of the outrage that people, what's the populist view of the day, what will be outraged about. I mean, Barack Obama, any elected politician, particularly American politicians, they have proud records in terms of their country, and they have terrible records in terms of human rights. America, which I'm very fond of, visited many, many times and worked in different parts of America, North and South and Central America. But they have, America has a terrible record in terms of human rights, whether it's Democrat or Republican. And Barack Obama, my thoughts about Barack Obama is the great work he did on underprivileged people in America, Obamacare, the legislation he introduced, and which the current President Trump has done his best to overthrow, although he's left some of it still in place. Obama turned out not to be apparently a great leader, but a great policymaker. And I think that heritage, that legacy he left behind, is something that he can be proud of.
Okay.
And I think you won't be
joining any protests at any of the events anyway while he's here. You've kind of a neutral enough view on it.
One way or the other, that's true, yeah.
All right. Ray, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colin.
Give it to him or not?
Give it to him.
Go on, make the pitch. Why?
Well, let's put it this way. He always ask ourselves, did he do any good? He did. And that means it should be rewarded in some way. Now, it's not $1 million or $10 million. It's a commemoration or a kind of a glory to him, which is good. You know, I think we should. No problem. Yes.
Right. I mean, you know, as I say, look, the legacy is mixed. People would say he drew a red line on chemical weapons in Syria and then he didn't enforce it. You know, there were 10 times as many drone strikes carried out as under the administration of George W. Bush by Barack Obama. You know, he made great noises about peace in the Middle East at the beginning of his presidency and it petered out and came to naught. So people, you know, might look at it and say a lot of the fuss and praise surrounding Barack Obama was based on a good deal of hype.
Well, that's very true. But we have to reflect on other presidents who were in America and did various things which were not pleasant, and in fact some of them were destructive. For instance, Harry Truman with the two atom bombs. No other American president has done that since. So has he done good? That's what we have to ask ourselves. Yes, he has done good. Has he done some destructive things? Yes, he had. But he was fighting in Afghanistan. He was protecting his troops over there. What else could he do? Up against the Taliban? Nobody's been able to defeat them. So Afghanistan has always been a problem for anybody going in there. Go back to Alexander the Great. Couldn't conquer it.
I suppose the number of civilians killed him, apart from fighting the Taliban, it was the number of civilians that were killed by the drone strikes. He was also dropping them in Yemen, in across the border in Pakistan, in Somalia, in Mali, in Niger, in loads of other places, you know, where the Taliban weren't about. And, you know, there were a number of civilian casualties which dropped over the course of his presidency. But initially, you know, the description of who was an acceptable target for drones during his presidency was a pretty controversial criterion. I think anyone over the age of 18 in a battle zone. And as I say, he ended up dropping 10 times more than George W. Bush. So that wouldn't make you look at this and say, look, 2017, they conferred it on him. Let's not make a fuss about making sure he gets it. You think there should be a formal ceremony, do you?
I can't see a problem with it. I mean, you mentioned there presidents dropping bombs. During the Second World War, look at the destruction of Cannes and all the French people who were killed there.
Roosevelt and Truman are not being offered the freedom of Dublin City by Ray McAdam, and you know, not that they could be anymore, but you know, John F. Kennedy, I think, is the last president to get the freedom of the city.
And that's true. Yes.
So, but you know, it's in this situation. I suppose the current Lord Mayor of Dublin has gone out of his way to an extended invitation to a formal ceremony. You think that's only right, do you?
I do. I can't. What is the harm in it? The man, did he do some good? He did. That's what we look to. Did he do good? No president, no ruler has ever been absolutely 100% perfect. Nobody. Right. You name a ruler who is 100% perfect. None.
Would you go to the ticketed event to hear him talk?
Yes, if I could afford the ticket.
Right. Did you look it up? Did you find out how much the tickets are?
No, I haven't done that, no.
Right, we might have a look at that.
How much are they, do you know?
I actually don't off the top of my head. What do you think of the notion, though, of, you know, and Vincent, maybe you'll give us your thoughts on this when Ray is done, the notion of, you know, former US president touring around, doing ticketed events and, you know, as a sort of a money-making exercise. What do you think of it, Ray?
Well, I mean, it is a money-making exercise. I mean, that's America for you all over, isn't it? America's the dollar capital of the world. People are driven by earning money. Capitalism personified. So, I mean, that's in the blood. So, I don't see a problem with that either. If people want to pay to go to see him, let them do so.
Right. What questions would you ask him yourself? If you were in the hot seat instead of Fintan O'Toole, what question would you ask Barack Obama?
I'd simply say to him, ex-President Obama, if that's the proper address to make, how are you going to help us in the future? Can you do anything to influence political system in America? That's what I'd ask him.
Right. You wouldn't be optimistic, though, with the current incumbent, given that the previous things he's had to say about President Obama.
You mean, yes. All I'll say about that is he's the elected president of America by the people of America. We have to respect that, even though you may not respect that.
All right.
We have to respect that as the president of America. So let him say what he has to say. Let him do what he has to do. The truth will out.
Okay, Vincent.
That old saying applies.
Okay, Vincent Kenny, what would you ask if you had the chance to be in the hot seat? Give us your. Would you pay for a ticket? You wouldn't. First of all, I think you said you wouldn't be paying for a ticket.
No, I wouldn't. I think it's close to £90, if I remember correctly.
Right.
It's quite expensive. I'm amazed that anyone would pay to hear what you can get free on any publication back or bound. Now, what was Fintan asked?
Well, that's it. You get the, I suppose, they would argue you get a unique line of questioning by Fintan O'Toole.
Yeah.
No doubt he's done his homework on. What would you ask if you were in Fintan O'Toole's place?
Well, Barack Obama is an intellectual. That's one thing that he hasn't. But I'd be careful with my question. The question I think what a lot of people are curious about is how has that Democrat political establishment collapsed so dramatically? And you know, it almost feeds conspiratorial theories. How could a party like the Democratic Party and Barack Obama, one of the strongest and foremost leaders of the party, along with Clinton, how could they have allowed it to collapse so dramatically, to drift so far from their Labour Party, American Labour Party ideals of the working man? And
okay.
Well,
okay, that's the question you'd ask. Emmanuel Sweeney, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colin. My question for Obama would be the number of bombs he dropped during the year of 2016. I understand it was the highest number of bombs dropped by any president, 26,000 on 6 different countries. How many civilians died in those bombings and what was the justification for them? Furthermore, as regards Ireland, surely our destiny should be neutrality and peace. What contribution can we make to the world from our history? We suffered centuries of colonial abuse and we see America now in all its glory in regard to Gaza and its failures. Surely we need to side for global peace rather than people who have been involved in dreadful wars.
Okay, well, I suppose Barack Obama, just on the colonialism point, Barack Obama's father grew up in Kenya. Kenya had its own share of colonial oppression. We had, you know, I think the British government recently made settlements for the treatment of the Mau Mau prisoners who were incarcerated there. I don't think President Obama's father was any particular fan of that period of Kenya's history. Is it right to portray Barack Obama as somehow being on the side of colonialism when that's his family history?
Well, I'd be much more concerned rather than his father. His father is accountable for himself. I'd be concerned about Barack Obama's decision to bomb 6 different countries and the American involvement. First of all, we talk about Afghanistan. What business had Russia or America been in Afghanistan? What was their interest? They live in the United States. Why would they be interfering in other countries? Surely that's the problem we have all around the world, the interference of colonial powers in other countries, not only in history, the devastation, but Ireland in particular, who suffered so much for centuries under British colonialism. Surely we should be on the side of global peace rather than warmongers and people who are... If you look at the expenditure now on weapons, Europe is going to spend billions on weapons. What money is being spent on peacemaking? I'd like to know that. America's spending billions selling cruise missiles. Great business to be done in the industrial war complex, which was warned about by, I think, one of the great generals of World War II.
That was Eisenhower when he was closing out his term as president. He warned about the military-industrial complex and the power of the
military-industrial complex. And now we're moving around in the world preparing. It looks like inevitably we're moving towards terrible war. And what are we doing? What's Ireland's contribution? Is it to pay 2,000 to listen to Obama talking? Have we lost our senses? Are we lost direction in the country?
On the other side of things, you know, Barack Obama, people might be underwhelmed by what his legacy was, but, you know, by contrast to the last two American presidents, during his time as president, he sent George Mitchell to the Middle East. During one of the conflicts in Gaza, he refused to transfer Hellfire missiles to Israel. He tightened up the protocol so that, you know, the US military couldn't do military-to-military arms transfers, that it would have to be run through official channels. And at the last time of voting at the UN Security Council on the legal status of, or on condemning the building of illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, John Kerry, his Secretary of State, abstained rather than vetoed, and the resolution at the Security Council was passed. So his legacy, for people who are concerned about the international stage and, you know, the likes of the situation in the Middle East, is arguably more positive than the last two American presidents, for people, you know, who want to see some solution arrived at there.
Yeah, but you see, at the end of the day, you have to judge by what he did when he was president. And we have the record of the amount of bombings that occurred. And that's really where I have a red line in regard to the matter. I don't think that you can look at little positive things, and that's all right. But in the end of the day, the Yemen was bombed to oblivion. And we have the whole situation in Syria. We have the whole situation.
He did hold back in Syria. You could argue that when he drew the red line about chemical weapons, and then he didn't follow up, you know, after the chemical attacks, he didn't go all out and bomb Syria. In fact, he cooperated with the Russians so that the chemical weapons could be passed off to Russia. He was criticised for not punishing Syria for the use of chemical weapons. He allowed Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, to come up with an arrangement where Syrian chemical weapons would be taken out of the country. He did get criticism for that, but he didn't take the opportunity to drop payloads of bombs on the Assad regime.
Yeah, well, if I could just move the conversation back to Ireland's position in terms of our outlook on the world. We seem to be kind of following trends that occur every other day in different places. Surely we have a destination of our own as a country, a newly independent state, in regard to world peace. As I refer back again to the billions that have been spent on weapons, who is spending any money on peacemaking? Surely Ireland has a huge role to play in mediation and trying to develop a kind of a system for global peace. Surely that's our destiny. The men of 1916 didn't die for the kind of Ireland that's, you know, in tandem with these countries that are all militaristic countries. Surely we have a destiny of neutrality and a contribution.
The men of 1916 were not neutral. In the proclamation, they say are gallant allies in Europe because they were getting arms from the Kaiser.
Well, in terms of the necessities of fighting for independence, I don't see that as a normal continuum. That was a special situation where Ireland was trying to free itself from centuries of horrific abuse in terms of our language. In 1800, we had 3.5 million Irish speakers. Where are those speakers now? We had a population of 8 million in 1845, 2.9 in 1962.
So how would that legacy be betrayed by handing over an award that was already voted on in 2017 to Barack Obama?
Well, I can't account for what councillors decide and so on, but there are other moralities beside those of elected officials. Countries have intellectuals and people of thoughtful consideration who have other opinions. We cannot focus a whole intellectualisation of a country into elected officials, because we can see the failures on all fronts in that regard. So I think that I would go back to really what Ireland can offer the world, and I think that we should be distancing ourselves from anyone who's involved in militaristic exploits and trying to develop a policy of global peace making.
Okay, well, just to inform listeners, that vote in 2017 was 30 voted in favour of giving Barack Obama freedom in the city, 30 voted, 23 in favour, and there were 4 abstentions. John Lyons, Andrew Keegan, Tina McVeigh and Hazel de Nortun left the council chamber when the appointment was being made. There are people before profit councillors there. So that's how the tally added up on that occasion. Now, Sean O'Haragan, good afternoon to you.
How are you doing, Colin? How are you?
He shouldn't bother stopping in Dublin at all. He should continue the road southeast, would be your view. Am I right in thinking that?
Straight down the M9, where he could get the train from Houston to McDonald Station in Kilkenny.
And what... All right, your line is a bit dodgy there, but we'll persist for another few seconds and see if it improves. What would await him in Kilkenny?
Well, but the way that Kilkenny is the gravestone and the burial place of his great-great-great-granduncle, who was John Kearney, who was mentioned by one of the speakers, provost of Trinity College and the bishop, the Anglican bishop of the Diocese of Ossory, somebody who made a huge contribution, and who was, I think, if I remember correctly, a first cousin of the famous Paul McCarney, who left from
your pearls of wisdom, unfortunately, are dropping out as your line is kind of intermittent there, Sean. So we're gonna take a quick break. We'll re-establish the line. We'll be back to you. Back in a minute.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
Now, before we took a quick break there, we were talking about the award of Freedom of the City on Barack and Michelle Obama in 2017 by Dublin City Council. Never formally bestowed on them. Barack Obama's back in September. The opportunity, Ray McAdam, the current Lord Mayor, says, is there to give it to them now, and he's written to them to ask them to accept it. We don't know what's going to happen there, but Councillor Sean O'Haragan is making the pitch, not for the formal bestowal of the Freedom of Dublin on the Obamas, but to have him down to Kilkenny. Sean O'Haragan, take it from the top again. What would await him in Kilkenny?
Well, what would await him is visit to St. Canice's Cathedral, where his great-great-great-granduncle, John Kearney, who was the Bishop of Ossory, the Anglican Bishop of Ossory, and also for a period the Provost of Trinity College, he would be very welcome to visit that grave in St. Canice's Cathedral, a place that obviously has made a huge contribution to the history of Ireland and also to the history of Kilkenny.
Right. Well, would you make it worth his while with an award? Is there a Freedom of Kilkenny award waiting for him there?
Well, it hasn't been discussed, but I'm sure we could certainly put it on the table. And, you know, this invitation has been extended by a number of former mayors of Kilkenny, including myself, and the current mayor of Kilkenny, John Coonan, is very happy and is making contact with Mr. Obama's office. Unfortunately, Colin, I was one of those who didn't secure a ticket to the event in Dublin. I gave up. They went over €100, despite the fact that I am a big fan of Barack Obama and would love to see him live. I was in College Square when he mentioned the famous Is Fader Lane, and that was an incredible occasion. And I think, you know, and I think it's worth pointing out, Colin, that unlike the present incumbent in D.C., Barack Obama is the holder of the Nobel Peace Prize. I know some people don't agree with that, but I certainly feel that he did a lot more good in the world than he did.
Right. I think he'd even concede himself that it was a slightly premature award of it. But I suppose the burning question about the Freedom of Kilkenny is, where could he graze his sheep if he did get it? We know Dublin Freedom gives you the benefit of being able to graze your sheep in St. Stephen's Green. Are there any grazing rights in around Kilkenny with the Freedom of Kilkenny?
Well, I think we might have a bit of negotiation to do with the OPW if we were to look for grazing rights in the grounds of Kilkenny Castle. But that would be the most obvious place. but I'm sure they might consider it. But you know, and just one moment on it, when we had another visit from another important personage a couple of years ago, when the then Prince Charles visited Kilkenny Castle, and I was, as a school principal of Muckleghale School, brought a group of kids from our school down to show him the font of hurling just outside the main entrance to Kilkenny Castle.
Right. You're not...
And I was able to point out to his aides that the both hurling and the Irish language had been banned in Kilkenny Castle in the statutes of Kilkenny, and here we were those hundreds of years later, both alive and well, thankfully.
Okay, you're from a footballing county yourself, and still in celebratory humour.
Still in celebratory humour. I'm looking out in Ballinskellig Bay and thinking about the very important connections that were mentioned there between Daniel O'Connell and Frederick Douglass. And Frederick Daniel O'Connell brought Frederick Douglass to Kilkenny. So there's certainly, and Barack Obama is a huge apostle of Frederick Douglass and his leadership.
Okay.
So, you know, I mean, I think we would tie up a lot of connections. If we got him to Kilkenny, we would be delighted to see him. And if anybody, like I was last Friday and Saturday, Colm, if anybody has a spare old ticket to the Barack Obama talk with Fintan O'Toole, we'd be delighted to have it.
I'm sure. Yeah, well, you know, couldn't be a free one, Sean. That'd have to go in the old declaration of interest. But I think...
I think
the Jedi Force of the Skelligs might be interfering with the phone line there. So we'll let you go. Thanks to all. Thanks to Ray. Thanks to Vincent. Thanks to Emmanuel as well. We take a break. Back in a minute.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Talking at the top of the programme there about the ban that came in today on HHC. Still interested in your thoughts on that, because I found that reference in the Department of Health survey on the University Hospital Galway study found that this HHC, which is a synthetic, semi-synthetic cannabinoid, which was banned today, found that HHC was the second most common drug used by patients presenting with psychosis over a 21-month period in what they studied there. And that has been banned today. It comes apparently on foot of European Union and UN Commission for Narcotic Drugs identifying it as a serious risk to public health, which is something that psychiatrists and indeed family members of people who'd been using it were highlighting concerns about, whether that's in the form of vapes or jellies or tinctures or whatever form it was coming in. Edith Donoghue, good afternoon to you.
Hey, yeah.
You heard the call out at the top of the programme there, and we were talking about hexahydrocannabinol, or HHC, which might have been flying under a lot of people's radars. It's been in the country since around 2022, and 3 years on, the ban is coming in today. So maybe give us your own take on do you welcome it, first of all?
No, well, I don't think it should be legalised.
You agree with the ban that came in today, do you?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
And can you tell us why?
Because it's another addiction. A lot of times the cannabis leads to other drugs. It's a gateway to other drugs.
And you have a your line is just slightly scratchy there, but your concerns are that, you know, it could be a gateway drug. It's, you know, the reason it's banned is not because of that, but because of the harm in and of itself, based on the research that's cited there in the report. But what would be your concern, you know, around what people might be led on to?
Well, I will say this. In all the people that come in here to the Lighthouse and all the assessments that we do, one of the questions that we always ask is, what's the first drug you've ever taken? And it's mostly cannabis, weed, and the oil.
Right.
And
alcohol presumably features there as well, maybe that's not included in the questionnaire, is it?
No, that is included in the questionnaire, but it's mostly weed and cannabis. And then usually the alcohol would come after that.
Really, right. People got into other drugs even before alcohol.
Mostly the weed, cannabis, and the oil.
And tell us, sorry, you mentioned there the Lighthouse. Just for listeners who aren't familiar with TIG Lynn and what it is you do for people, can you give us just a short outline of what it is, the work you're doing there?
Yeah, so the Lighthouse, it's a homeless service where the homeless come in, they will get something to eat, they get clothing, toiletries. And then we also do assessments here and care plans for men and women going into drug treatment centres. We have a women's one in British Bay in Wicklow and the men's centre in County Ashford in Wicklow.
And people, you know, who are considering going into services, and we saw that report from the Rutland Centre during the week where there's a growing number of women contacting addiction services for cocaine is the primary source of addiction. What are you mostly seeing where you are in the Lighthouse? What's the main problematic drug, people's primary addiction?
Cocaine and alcohol. Cocaine and alcohol would be the main one.
You're coming at this from, you know, first-hand experience. You're not a commentator on the sidelines. You're somebody who's been through the recovery journey yourself.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I have been through the recovery journey. I've been in Tiggling myself in 2018. And only for Tiggling. Tiggling saved my life.
And for anyone who's out there, you know, listen, because, you know, rte.ie/helplines for anyone who is, you know, concerned about their own drug use or the drug use of somebody who's a loved one or a friend. You know, people can contact numbers through that. But in terms of the first steps into recovery, Edith, what was the first step you took?
The first step, I came into the Lighthouse to get to do an assessment. Before that, we had a family intervention where it was basically put to me if I didn't go to treatment that my kids were done with me. So I came into the Lighthouse, done an assessment, and I was waiting about 2 months before I got into Tiggling.
And do you think when you were in addiction and, you know, at the beginning of it, and I don't know what the first substance you used yourself was, but the likes of having HHC for sale as vapes and available and fairly easily accessible, do you think it would have been more difficult to get out of addiction when if that had been available when you were getting into addiction?
The vapes?
Yeah, the HHC vapes and the like, your experience of addiction, were they there, were they available when you were still in full addiction, addiction?
No, they wouldn't have been, no, they wouldn't have been. It was just the hash and the weed.
And would you have some sympathy then for, you know, people over the last 3 years where this has been available? Would you have some sympathy for services who are trying to deal with the after effects of this?
Of course.
Or even, you know, young people who have this available and they may not have been fully aware of the risks of it.
And you know, and that's it, because I wasn't even aware of any risks when I started in addiction myself. But people, they aren't aware. Like, there is education out there, but they're not aware until it happens to them. They don't know how it's going to affect them. They don't know the withdrawals they're going to go through and how it's going to affect them mentally. Like, it should be more in schools, if you ask me.
Do you think that can really combat it, you know, because the messages that are given out through schools, they're, you know, give out positive messages on all sorts of things, from, you know, being active, from anti-bullying to everything else. I mean, there's a limit maybe to what schools can do.
I suppose it's educating them, isn't it? It's educating them. It's letting them know of the risk. That's important.
And why is it, do you think, from your own insights, working at Tiggling, why is it that cocaine is the primary addiction of a lot of people coming in? Why has it become so popular with people?
Cocaine?
Is it availability, or is it how addictive it is, or is it all of the above?
It's it's a party drug. And like, it's everywhere. It's in the pubs, it's in the nightclubs, in houses. It's a party drug. It's a stimulant to keep you awake, makes you feel good, makes you feel confident. Do you know what I mean? Like, in my opinion, that would be one of the reasons why it's so available. Nowadays, it can be made in a lab. So it's synthetic drug mix.
And what are the effects that you're seeing in the aftermath? I mean, you know, you've given us an insight in there into why people are going down the road of using it for the highs and the party drug aspect of it. What are you seeing in the aftermath of that for people who are seeking treatment?
It's affecting their mental health. They're really depressed. They go into psychosis. And where they think that there's people following them, they think things are happening that's not really happening, but they're convinced it's happening. Very frightening. And then, like, you have girls who have families, no kids, and it affects the whole family. Like, the mental health, there's not enough services in this country for mental health. We have girls who are having suicidal thoughts, because they think they're going crazy and they just want out of that feeling, just want to end it all.
You know, but as you've pointed out, there are services people can contact, at least for the first steps of it. And as we said, rte.ie/helplines, if people are in distress, there are people that they can reach out to. You did reach out. You said yourself that you were in contact with Tig Lynn. How long did your journey of recovery last? I mean, you're obviously still addiction. It's not active addiction anymore, but how long did it take to get through the crisis phase of it?
When I was in treatment or before?
Well, the whole thing, you know, from the whole...
When I went in for my assessment, I was 2 months waiting, and then I got into Tig Lynn. And then when I went into Tig Lynn, I still wasn't thinking straight. It takes a while for the drugs or the alcohol to thaw from your brain, and for your brain to start repairing itself before you can think clearly. Do you know what I mean? When I was in there, I thought I was gone stupid because I couldn't take anything in from the classes. And it was only when that was said to me that the drugs are still tarring from my brain and my brain is starting to repair itself. I really thought I was gone stupid.
So when would you say, you know, you got clarity? When would you say that your physical recovery, because obviously there's a huge emotional element to beating the active stage of addiction, first of all, and probably has to go into whole areas of your life. But on the physical side of it, when would you say you first noticed meaningful kind of recovery?
I'd say 6 weeks into it, I start seeing myself physically better. I start putting on more weight. I start looking a lot better. My breathing was a lot better. Emotionally, that takes time because it's 9 months in the treatment centre, and that's where you do all the inside work. You get the counselling once a week. You see a key worker once a week, and then you also do classes Monday to Friday. Classes on anger, attitudes, behaviours, low self-worth, inner critic, you know, we're overthinking. Triggers, relapse prevention. For the whole 9 months, you're doing those classes, and they're very good. The classes help you to understand yourself more, and then getting to know yourself as a person.
And, you know, you mentioned there all that you have to go through and recognising your triggers and all of that. And you're working with Tig Lynn. You're around people who sometimes present in active addiction and that. I mean, I think anyone listening would pay tribute to the courage for you to come from where you were to where you are now. And I mean, every day must be a recommitment to staying clean and helping other people.
Do you know what? just even when the people come in, it reminds me of where I was at. And I never want to go back to that place. But my heart, that's where my heart is helping people, because I want to take people out of that situation. Because it doesn't just change them, it changes the family, the kids, everything.
And does it help you establish trust with them, you know, that you're coming from a similar place, yeah, that you've left behind, yeah, you know, the active addiction, where they might be when they're first meeting you?
Yeah, and I do even tell them things to help me, you know, just to try and encourage them and give them the hope. And let them know what's expected.
And have
because
you...
when I went in,
sorry, go on, yeah.
When I went in, I didn't know what to expect. But now we have pre-entry groups for the men and the women, and that's to help prepare them for tickling, which really helped.
And have you seen the effects of HHC to anyone who's, you know, presenting to Tiglin services, or is it not something really that's on your radar? What, you know, have you seen any of the effects of it?
It's to be honest, it's mostly weeds and cannabis.
Right.
The oil, not so much.
Okay. All right, Edith, stay with us because Paul's on the line there. Paul, good afternoon to you.
Hi, how's it going?
I'm not too bad now. Thanks. Thanks for getting in contact with us. Was HHC anywhere in your field of awareness? When did you come across it?
I suppose I came across it there when it kind of came big on the continent. There was lots of places selling it. And at the time, I suppose, I'm a recreational user, so on the weekends or whatever, like. And I found that, like, I didn't want to smoke anymore. I didn't want to do the gummies. I didn't want to deal with dealers. So it was a lot easier for me to go into a shop and buy something over the counter that I knew, you know, to a certain extent, that what was in it.
Right.
You know, so it was a safer option that way. And the fact that the health benefits of not smoking it anymore.
Right. And so, I mean, when you saw it being sold out of vape stands and that, you thought there was kind of some level of checks and balances in place.
Well,
and
I
that
did,
somehow it had
own,
been through
own.
Some approval system. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I had gone back and I had checked the manufacturers and I checked that they were actually actively testing it and producing certain analysis for the gummies, like, you know.
So do you agree with it being banned?
I agree that it should be more stringently controlled, yes. I don't think it should be sold through vape shop and stuff like that. But this comes back to HHC only exists because cannabis is illegal. If cannabis was legal in the morning, people wouldn't be using this synthetic drug, like.
Right. But as you said yourself, you were done with using cannabis and you wanted something that wasn't, you know, cannabis. So was this a better alternative?
I didn't want to be smoking. Yeah, it was, yeah, a better alternative, a more healthy alternative, because I wasn't smoking tobacco anymore.
And did you have no bad experience about it? No panic attacks, paranoia, whatever else, you know, any ill effects from it when you were using it?
No more so than normal THC. You know, it lasts for a few hours and then it's gone. You know, I think people are kind of looking down through their pint glass at people who use cannabis.
Right. So, sorry, just to be clear about that, you think that people are drawing a distinction between the use of alcohol and the use of illegal drugs, and you feel there's a misplaced sense of being on a moral high ground there.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, there is. Absolutely, there is.
What, like, I mean, look.
I agree with the ban in the sense that, you know, it's protecting people who are, you know, prone to psychosis, and maybe with this there is, you know, more susceptibility to it. But that's, you can look at other drugs, you know, alcohol being the number one, and look at all the associated side effects with that are a lot more than just psychosis.
Well, I mean, the University Hospital Galway study found HHC was the second most common drug used by patients presenting with psychosis over a 21-month period. I mean, that's not to be dismissed lightly.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I agree with that. But that's down to several factors, you know.
So you're questioning as to whether or not it was the key causal link there. You think people may have had other underlying factors.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the same as any person uses any drug. Some people are going to have an adverse reaction to it and some people won't.
Right. Well, have you read the study?
I haven't, no.
Right. I suppose, I mean, it may be worth reserving judgment on that.
I know people who, like, I don't know, I'd say I could count off. Do I know anyone who had any psychotic episodes related to cannabis use? Do I know a lot of people who've used cannabis? Yes.
But, you know, as you say yourself, one of the reasons HHC was on your radar at all was it was easier to get. You didn't have to deal with dealers who were, you know, by their very nature, engaged in an illegal activity. So your money wouldn't be supporting that. You went and you bought the vapes and everything else. You could cut out all of that. And it was more easily available. You could walk into a place and get it. You were listening to Edith there. She was saying that people present to Tig Lynn, they say their first experience with drugs, even before they experience alcohol, the thing that began them on the path into addiction was, in many cases, cannabis. So, I mean, removing HHC from publicly available places and taking it out of visibility, is that a good thing?
Overall, yes. But again, HHC only exists because cannabis isn't available. You know? That's the reason these HHCs are being sold so widely and openly, is because they're legal. Whereas if cannabis was legal, they'd be selling cannabis gummies. Would there be the same amount of, you know, psychosis-related episodes? I don't know.
Yeah, but people would say, look, you know, cannabis itself in its herbal form is, you know, it's the hydroponic cannabis that's bred for extra strength with high THC content and everything else. Also, you know, triggers psychosis in people, and that, you know, the idea that legalizing cannabis would cut out the black market, you know, you could put in safety procedures and everything else, but there would always be a black market on the area of price and the area of the strength of the drug, that, you know, maybe it's not as simple a fix just to legalize cannabis and cut the black market.
Well, the people who are going to benefit most from this making stuff illegal is the dealers, like, because it's going to force anyone who was using HHC, if they want to continue using it. I don't think it's physically addictive. I think it's mentally addictive, maybe.
Right.
But I think the drug dealers are the people who are going to benefit from this, because there will be more people, once they can't get it from, they can't get it from the shops, they'll go and find someone to get it for them.
Although it's packaged very differently. I mean, there may be people who are in no way attracted to smoking something. And the packaging of HHC as vapes, or, you know, in the colourful packaging or in edible formats and everything else, maybe people wouldn't be inclined to go down the road of smoking cannabis when, you know, HHC is presented in a completely different way.
No, I can understand that the marketing and everything is, you know, pretty flamboyant. But again, that wasn't me as an adult making that decision. You know, I was basically, you know, picking my recreational drug. Other people will pick, you know, like the cocaine epidemic in Ireland is crazy, crazy at the moment. Like.
Right. But, your experience of cannabis use and HHC didn't lead you on to anything else?
No, absolutely not. No. No.
So you took a drink and dabbled in cannabis, but that's where you left it, is it?
Yeah, I would say an awful lot of the cohort, my own age group, that would be very similar. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Although, I mean,
I don't think I'm an,
as you heard from Edith there, that's not where it stops for a lot of people.
Yeah, and again, I can't talk for everyone. I could just say that that's, you know, could be people who are susceptible to, you know, addiction, like, and like, fair play to that lady for working her way out of it, like, cause I know people who have, a lot of people, sure, everyone knows that, people who have a drink problem, you know.
Right. Edith, what Paul has said to you there, do you want to reply to him?
You know, I agree with what he's saying. I do agree with what he's saying. It's just in regards to the alcohol and the oil. The alcohol is socially accepted. Do you know, like, and it'd be the same with the oil if it was legal.
Absolutely. I agree with what you're saying.
Sorry, go on, Paul. Yeah, and I come back to you.
The Citizens Assembly I think it was last September they finished up, and like there were the legalization of cannabis according to that to the assembly was defeated by one vote, and even the voting system wasn't done properly. It was done by, you know, it wasn't done like accumulative. It was done by a single transferable vote, which we never use for any other decision making purposes. Like,
right,
different story.
And Edith, you know, while you welcome the ban coming in on HHC, you're not into throwing people in jail long term. You do want a health led approach. So would you be in favour of, broadly speaking, before we let you go, is it decriminalisation or, you know, giving people greater access to services? Where would you see the way forward is?
I would say.
Sorry, yeah, get Edith on yeah. that first. Yeah, go on, Edith.
I suppose more access to services and bring it into the schools. Okay. Educate the schools between from 14 and upwards.
All right, look, Edith, Paul, thanks very much.